I didn't think so. Bankers are anchors. So you need to borrow a full roll of money rather than root through the proverbial waste paper basket of non-traditional resources? Fine. I'm cool with that. But if you're going to borrow, you better ensure you use your cash to directly grow your fledgling business's bottom line. Don't use it for anything else. Until you have a belief system that maximizes what you have, think three sheets of TP here, you shouldn't borrow a penny. Only when you are able to take a dollar and stretch it a mile should you take in money to fuel your growth. The first source of money entrepreneurs traditionally think of is bankers. That's the old school approach and is probably the last place you should go. Bankers aren't bad people. They just don't easily understand non-traditional business plans and are risk averse by nature. Banks are looking for simple, low-risk investments that offer consistent return. They like to get involved with stuff they thoroughly understand and are highly confident will guarantee them a return. A new startup rarely fits the bill. If you do end up going to a bank, go with a small local one. They're typically far more aggressive. That's funny. Aggressive banker, right? Know this, bankers are anchors. Many entrepreneurs believe they can only get funding from banks. So when the bank rejects them or gives them unreasonable, shitty terms, these entrepreneurs believe that's the end of it. Bankers keep entrepreneurs anchored, unable to move forward to plan B. So if you shouldn't go to banks, where should you go? The best source of funding are the people who know you and know your capabilities. Who knows you better than you? Nobody. So the first place to borrow money is from you. Now don't cut me off here and say you don't have any money. You might have more than you think. Consider these options. eBay. Look through the attic, garage, and every crevice of your home. From baseball cards to old toys to your collection of slightly soiled porno mags. Somebody wants your crap and will pay good money for it. See what you've got, post it on eBay, and get some money in the door. As the old saying kind of goes, one man's shit is another man's non-shit. House. If you own a house, consider refinancing and pulling the equity out. If historical trends stay true, your house will continue to increase in value over the long term. Just make sure you can afford the new payment and avoid frequent refinancing, which may cost you dearly in the long run. Car. But what if you don't own a house? You may have a car. Did you know you could refinance your car? You can if you own it. Just be careful, since cars decrease in value over time, borrowing against them is a financial risk. 401k and IRA. While 401k, IRA, and other investment account money is intended for retirement, there are situations in which you can borrow from yourself penalty-free. Of course, you can just take the money out directly too, but be aware that you might take a government-induced penalty and tax beatdown. 529 plan. The 529 plans are intended for college savings, but can be freed up for other purposes too. If you have one, see if you can get the funds out penalty-free. What better education can you get than entrepreneurialism anyway? Trade a paperclip for a house. If you couldn't squeeze enough money out of yourself, it's time to start looking at alternatives. Most will advise you to continue down the funding path of the four Fs: founder, family, friends, and fools. Per usual, the pundits are wrong. You are the first F, Ms. or Mr. Business Founder, and you can still get cash or supplies of your own accord. Before you run out asking for funds from other sources, try trading up. Kyle McDonald proved to the world that he could trade one red paperclip for a house. At the end of 1 year, he not only had his house, but a lot of buzz and a book deal. The story of one red paperclip is true, amazing, and a real eye-opener. Kyle started off with a couple basic things, a computer and a paperclip, a simple four-sentence prosperity plan, and a variant of a quarterly plan, and then back them with immediate action. Four simple sentences placed on Craigslist, and Kyle was off to the races. What he accomplished was nothing short of amazing. This one red paperclip is currently sitting on my desk next to my computer. I want to trade this one red paperclip with you for something bigger or better, maybe a pen, a spoon, or perhaps a boot. If you promise to make the trade, I will come and visit you, wherever you are, to trade. I'm going to make a continuous chain of up trades until I get a house. With that, Kyle was off to the races. All he needed was his natural talent, a computer, a paperclip, and his time. The red paperclip was traded for a pen, which after a few trades became a toolbox, and then a generator, which went on to become a snowmobile, and then a box truck, and after a few more trades became an acting role in a movie, which then resulted in his destiny. 14 trades, and 1 year later, Kyle moved into his new house in the town of Kipling, in Saskatchewan, Canada. Think about what you have to offer that is of value to someone else. Can you provide training, service, or stuff to someone in exchange for something you need? Working with limited resources requires discipline and commitment and is clearly a harder path than someone handing you money, but the results can be phenomenal. Shoot, if a paperclip can get you a house, just imagine what you could get for trading this book. Maybe you could have your own island. Funds from the folks. After squeezing money out of yourself, your belongings, and your skills, it may be necessary to tap the second F, family. It's time to raise some cash through mom and dad and your wealthy uncle, Heckelbert. When it comes to borrowing family money, there are inherent pros and cons. The upside is that the agreement will probably be quick and will not require lawyers or personal guarantees. The downside is summed up in the word probably. Accepting a loan from a family member is risky because if your business goes sour, things can get ugly fast and last an eternity. Think about all those Thanksgiving dinners where your Uncle Heckelbert recounted the story of how you screwed him, threw a turkey leg at you, and stormed out. Nobody needs that. Nobody. If you are going to ask the folks for some funding, there are a few things to consider. A family loan is just like any other loan, and you need to pay the money back. Unless, of course, your folks just write you a check, pat you on the back, and tell you to take it. In that case, give them a big hug and kiss and get your ass to work. But chances are your family needs money to live too. So if you agree to a loan, use this little trick to pay it back and sustain a friendly family. Borrow more than you need. For example, if you need $5,000, ask for $8,000 and use the extra $3,000 to start the payback process on time or even a little early. This affords you more time to get on your feet and generate revenue. At the same time, it shows your family your commitment to paying the loan back and keeps you in their good graces. As you get in the payback rhythm, it will become habitual and easier to pay, and you won't feel like a schmuck. Sometimes even the best plans don't pan out. If you can't pay back your loan on time or are having any difficulty whatsoever, tell your family lenders as far in advance as possible and work out a new plan to pay the money back. Communication is the key, and it could save your Thanksgiving. Vendors have your money, borrow it back, plus other options. Maybe the folks aren't an option, and you don't have a penny to your name. There are still plenty of options to consider before you start selling off pieces of your budding company. If you are doing at least a little bit of business, you have even more options. Vendor loans. Contact vendors and tactfully but passionately tell them your vision, goals, and financial needs. They will have a good understanding of your market and a great understanding of you, and may want to invest in your growth. If they consider you a good client, your vendors may give you very favorable terms, loans, or an equity deal. Chances are, if they help you out financially, they're going to make sure that you are a priority on their list. That can help you. As your business grows, your need for their products and services will increase as well, and you're not about to switch vendors after all they've done for you, are you? Figure out how it can be a win-win and present your case. At the very least, you may get better payment terms on existing orders. Client loans. Clients are also a good source of funding, but asking them for money is a little bit risky. Customers may fear that you are in financial trouble, and you may lose them as clients. Prepaying clients. A great way to get money is to offer clients a prepayment or retainer option. Ask them to pay up front at the time they place their order for some or all of the services and products. If it is reasonable and fair, offer them a discount for prepaying. Sell receivables and POs. Factoring companies will pay you today for money that is due to you in the future. Do you have some big invoices outstanding with clients that would benefit you if they were collected today rather than in 60 days? If so, factoring may work. Keep in mind, though, factoring companies are out to make a living, too. They will only take on invoices that they are confident they can collect and will take a pretty large percentage, sometimes paying you only 75% of the total invoice. Factoring companies offer the same deal for purchase orders. So if you really need cash now, once the client commits to using your company and issues a PO, you can go to a factoring company and get the coin right away. Friends, we already discussed how to raise money from yourself and your family. When it comes to friends, you must treat them like family. Remember, the consequence of a loan gone bad can run much deeper than just bad debt. This time, instead of a turkey leg being thrown your way, it will probably be an empty beer bottle. Fools. When it comes to the final F, fools, I suggest you never borrow from them. I think the term fools is thrown around to be a little cheeky, but they are out there. I don't like to consider this approach, though, since a fool implies a win-lose scenario. Basically, you are saying you will get the cash you need from people who are idiots for lending it to you. Either way, someone is going to lose. And if your foolish lenders lose, it probably won't be pretty for you. Even if you come out okay, I believe in karma. What comes around goes around. Taking money from a fool sets you up for paybacks someday, somehow. As Mr. T says, I pity the fool. Credit cards. When I launched my first company and needed inventory for clients, I purchased all of it on credit cards. I was able to borrow about $25,000 through credit cards, even with zero income and a marginal credit history. Here's the trick I used. I signed up for about 10 cards and then signed my wife up for 10 more. Between the two of us, we got $25,000 of total credit. When I made a purchase, I rolled the balance over to new cards at zero interest. Every chance I got, I would pay off one card, get the limit raised, and start loading it up again. I closed the other cards. This is not a clean method and not great for your credit history, but it is very easy to get and helped me access money immediately. Don't borrow to cover your mistakes. I nearly destroyed my company by borrowing to death. It wasn't the credit cards. I paid all of those back. It was the bank loans. I borrowed $250,000 and blew it. One of the biggest mistakes I made was using the money to cover payroll. I gave myself a bloated salary and paid for employees who weren't needed. Finally, when the money ran out, I had to face the truth and cut my salary, fire employees, and get back on track. But I still had a huge amount of debt on my shoulders. The lesson in this story is that if you are borrowing money to cover your own salary and others, you clearly have too much money going out. At that moment, you need to make the hard decision of letting people go. Chances are you could be doing just as much work, or even more, with fewer people. Get rid of those folks and their salaries who aren't adding substantially to the bottom line. You are going to have to fire them at some point, so you might as well do it now and give them a little severance so they can find better jobs elsewhere. If you can't afford salaries, consider hiring subcontractors to do some of the work an employee would. You'll save the cost of matching Social Security and Medicare payments, and you'll save on the cost of employee benefits such as health insurance. Just make sure you issue 1099s at the end of the year for eligible contractors and take out a workman's comp policy to cover them, just in case. Also, if you are paying yourself a fat salary that the company needs to borrow to cover, stop. Pay yourself only what the company can afford and only pay that after you've taken your profit first. We'll talk about the profit first method shortly. For now, just enjoy being overwhelmed with anticipation. Don't give personal guarantees. I give in. You tried everything else and it didn't work. Now it is time to go to a banker. They better have a good offer or a really hot teller. Otherwise, I wish you wouldn't go. But if you do seek funding from a bank and it makes an offer, write it without a personal guarantee, a PG. A PG basically says that if you can't pay the loan back anything that is owed by you legally goes to the bank. Of course, if you are the bank, you want to reduce your risk as much as possible, so you sure as hell better get the borrower to sign his life away. Despite this conflict, there can be mutual ground. The bank may not require PG if you can reduce its risk considerably. The easiest way to eliminate the PG is by lowering the loan amount. There's an old saying in banking, if you can't pay the bank back $100, that's your problem. If you can't pay the bank back $100 million, that's their problem. Other methods may include involving a cosigner, such as a family member or even a key client. Seek a way, and you may just find it. Take action now. Building on the tips and strategies included in my book, complete the following exercises to create a customized list of resources that could work for your business. This part is really fun and totally addictive. You'll be scavenging with the best of the TPEs in no time. 1. Make a list of everything you need for your business that you know you can get for free. Then make a list of everything else you need. Next, use your TPE ingenuity to come up with ways to get those things for free, too. 2. If you just can't get something for nothing, take your list and brainstorm ways you could barter for what you need. 3. If you still need stuff or services that will cost money, identify ways you could get what you need on the cheap. Chapter 9, A Good Solid Flow. A penny saved is a penny earned. Benjamin Franklin. Recently, I received a notice congratulating me on donating a gallon of blood. After some Wikipedia research, I learned that the human body has slightly over a gallon of blood pumping through it. Clearly, if I gave a gallon of blood in one sitting, I would be a goner. Shoot, even if I only donated one-third of my blood, approximately 3 pints, in one sitting, I might suffer from tough consequences. But since I donate 1 pint of blood at a time, my body hardly misses it, and I can donate as frequently as 7 times a year and not miss it. Apparently, my donations piled up, and in a very short time, I had given a gallon of blood. Cash is the lifeblood of your business. I think it's hard to argue otherwise. Shouldn't you treat your money like the blood of your business? Just as blood is often required in a medical emergency, a business in fiscal trouble often requires an infusion of capital. You never know when a patient will need donated blood, but with a pool of easily accessible blood reserves, the chance for survival dramatically increases. Sometimes your business problems are predictable, and other times they will blindside the hell out of you. With a supply of easily accessible cash, the chance for business survival dramatically increases. Do you see the value in regularly donating business cash flow to your reserves? The best system is to take your profit first. What do I mean by this? Every time money comes into your business, and I mean every time, automatically transfer a percentage of the money into a separate account. Just like a pint of blood, a healthy business will hardly feel the withdrawal. In fact, if you do it first, you will never miss it. I like to call this reserve the Profit First Account, PFA. How much money can be transferred to the PFA without threatening the health of your business? Most stable companies should be able to post a profit of 10% to 25% after all expenses. So start with a low threshold wherein maybe 5% of every inbound dollar goes to the PFA. Over time, slowly increase the percentage and monitor cash flow closely to see if your business gets woozy. Don't stow away too much money too quickly. Just as donating way too much blood in one sitting is harmful, rapidly draining cash from business operations could cripple or kill your organization. Once you have adjusted expenses and cash outflow to sustain your PFA withdrawals, you will quickly accumulate a tremendous cash reserve. Should tough times come knocking on your door, and they often do, you will have your PFA to back you up and, if necessary, bail you out. Of course, as your cash reserves grow, they will ultimately be in excess of any imaginable rainy day needs. At that point, you should take portions as an equity distribution. Trust me, it's a real nice way to reward yourself for running a healthy business. If you've never given blood, I strongly encourage you to do it. There's no question it saves lives. If you don't currently donate to your company's PFA account, I strongly encourage you to start. There's no question. It saves companies. Applying the PFA process to your business. As with everything else in your business, your profit first account isn't going to happen unless you take action. Start out slow and easy and build your way up. Here are the steps to take. First, research financial trends on Yahoo Finance to determine what healthy businesses in your industry earn in profit. Calculate industry profits as a percentage of revenue. For example, I studied many service/investment companies and determined that 20% is a healthy profit number and is achievable among the top performing companies in my industry. 20% is my profit first percentage, PFP. That being said, 20% may be too much money for a young business. So initially, your company may be best served by having 5% of revenue going to the PFA, adjusting contributions to 8% in the following quarter and 11% in the next, and so on. Continue to ratchet up the PFA savings slowly but surely, quarter by quarter, until you are at the optimal amount determined from your research. Second, establish your PFA so that it's not easy to transfer money out of the account. Third, immediately transfer your PFP from every deposit made as a result of a sale, and I do mean every deposit, into your PFA. Fourth, use the remaining percentage of money deposited to run your company and pay your salary. Fifth, distribute 50% of the PFA balance to equity owners, hopefully just you, on a quarterly basis and leave the remaining 50% in the account for backup. Here are some of the benefits of the PFA. 1. The PFA is always available as a rainy day fund, but it better be a serious storm. I mean thunder and lightning and stuff. 2. You will adjust spending and build a healthy business using the money left over after you withdraw the PFP. You'll probably even earn additional profit on the leftover money. 3. The PFA is a simple monitoring system. Once you have an established PFA for a year or so, you can watch the trend of the PFA at distribution time. If the PFA is growing, so is your business. If the PFA is flat or going down, so is your business. 4. A company that shows a consistent or increasing profit quarter after quarter is much more valuable to a prospective buyer. And you want this, since when you sell your company is when you make some real money. 5. The PFA is a way to get your big lines of credit. The more you have stashed away, the more lenders are willing to lend. Good luck trying to get a bank line of credit if you don't have any money. But as your PFA grows and banks know you have cash, they will gladly offer you lines of credit and so will others. Consider your line of credit as a second rainy day fund. This PFA plan is simple and it works, but make sure you avoid the stumbling blocks. 1. If the money in the PFA is easy to take out, it's tempting to borrow from it and screw it up. The money must be secure and not easily accessible. To address this, team up with someone whom you trust and will hold you accountable. Have her co-sign on your PFA account. Set it up so that your co-signer cannot withdraw money, but both of you need to sign a check in order for you to take money out. Similar to how two people must turn a key to release a nuclear missile. Just like that. 2. PFAing too much money too fast can be a drain on your company. A lot of people get too gung-ho about this system and start taking the goal PFP, not the starting PFP, immediately, and then give up when their company has no money for expenses. The fix is to start now, but to start slow. Give yourself and your business time to adjust to the PFA by starting with a small PFP, even if it's just 1%. 3. Believe it or not, PFA money grows quickly. Within a few years, the account can actually grow so much that it becomes a risk should there be a lawsuit or some other crisis. If you are in this position, be grateful. Then, on an annual basis, talk with your attorney and your accountant and determine how much of your PFA you should cash out or spend. You could use it to make a major purchase, for example, or it could be your personal year-end bonus. It is nice being the owner. Try to strike a balance between legal protections, business asset reduction, and keeping enough in the coffers should a disaster strike. 4. Pushing profitability forces slower growth, since that money can't be used to invest in marketing or sales. The discipline of having profit from day one greatly outweighs the loss of faster growth. With the PFA, you are assuring your wealth. By growing fast, you are gambling on wealth. I suggest you don't gamble. 5. For goodness sake, make sure you put your PFA in an interest-bearing account. Don't just put it in a checking account. You are putting this money away for quite a while. Have it work for you, not go on vacation. Put it in a money market or other stable interest-bearing liquid investment. Take action now. Completing the next 3 steps could save your business and make your life. Not doing it will put your business in jeopardy and completely stress you out. Just do it. 1. Using the method outlined in this chapter, calculate your goal profit first percentage, PFP. 2. Identify a starting PFP that you can easily manage. Most people start around 5% and go up from there until they reach their goal PFP. 3. Set up an interest-bearing profit first account, PFA, and start funneling your starter PFP into the account with each and every deposit. Chapter 10. Keep your business to yourself. A fool and his equity are soon parted. Me. So you have a brand new business that is not worth anything yet, right? Your company is far from generating revenue. You don't have a single client, let alone a phone system to receive calls. It's just a baby. So why not give your best friend some equity now? After all, it ain't worth nothing. If you have or plan to have a child, would you give a portion of your parental rights to your friend, your neighbor, or the doctor at the local hospital? I hope you're thinking, no freaking way. It's your kid, for God's sake. Your kid, jeez. A child requires a tremendous amount of time to feed, nurture, train, and keep healthy so he'll stop puking on you. But watching your kid grow is more than worth it. Guess what, Chiefy? Your business is your baby. While it doesn't look like much now, you will be putting a tremendous amount of time, tears, and sweat into it. As with a baby, you will need to feed and nurture your business, keep it healthy, and teach it not to vomit on you. As your newborn business grows, it will slowly but surely turn into a strong, healthy young adult. It would be a shame for you to do all that grueling work only to be sharing the parental rights when the business starts hitting its stride. So don't do it. Don't give your baby away. Most partnerships fail. Some end in a bitter, emotional corporate divorce. Some end with stunted progress. And a few others end with a handshake and a smile. I can already hear your argument. If I am the parent, wouldn't it be better if I had a spouse to help me care for my baby? Wouldn't it be better to have someone to help change the diapers? I would say yes, if you really were going to have a child. In that case, a good solid partnership is critical. But you are starting a company, not having a real baby. So don't get married to equity partners. Growing a business and parenting have many similarities. But one of the biggest differentiators is that your business can hire many spouses to help you feed and grow the corporate baby. There are many ways to bring in extraordinary people and compensate them without sacrificing equity. Treating people well, as you would want to be treated, enables you to create situations wherein both you and the other guardians building the company are compensated in a way that does not include equity. Partners without equity. I don't care how close you are to the other person, how well you know her, or even if she is your twin, people are different. Differences are a good thing when it comes to building a company, but small differences can be a big issue with multiple leaders at the top. Different perceptions of risk. Launching a business is risky, no question. It requires serious head preparation, an enabling belief system, and a crystal clear vision. Danger lurks if you and your partners go in with different beliefs about the risks involved. Contrary beliefs are limiting and damaging. For example, one partner may be so skittish, she calls it quits too early, and the other may be so bullheaded, he becomes a dead man walking. Too much of a good thing. Variety is good when it comes to building a team, but you can't win a game with only quarterbacks. When you add the variable of another leader, the vision can be slightly different. The beliefs may vary, and the focus can go askew. As long as the company's progress is consistent with the collective partner's desires, things are good. But when things go off track, watch out. Egos can overtake ethics. Pissiness can kill passion, and selfishness can destroy success. Different immutable laws. A lot of people go into business with someone they know simply because they know them and the path ahead seems less scary with a partner. Good acquaintanceship doesn't make for a good partnership. For your business to succeed, you and your partner must share the same immutable laws and have complementary talents and strengths. Different levels of energy. We all have varying levels of energy and opinions about our own energy levels in comparison to those of others. One partner who happily works through the night may consider the other lazy for leaving work in time for dinner. The partner leaving at 5 p.m. after all of her work is done may consider her night owl partner inefficient and distracted. What may seem like a balance in the beginning may lead to serious conflict later on. Conflicting vision. A markedly different vision very often divides partners. Going in, everyone says he wants to have a multi-million-dollar company, but as time passes, complacency can kick in. The vision of a large company may be offset by the work demands of a growing business. When varying visions stop sharing a common path, problems arise and things get nasty. As you build your company, your biggest investment will be your time, and I can guarantee that no one in your business is going to invest as much time in your business as you, nor will anyone have the same impact as you. Your company may not look like much now, but it doesn't matter where you are now. All that matters is your prosperity plan, your destiny. How big do you envision your business becoming? When it achieves these goals, do you want to share the rewards with other equity partners, even if they didn't work as hard or weren't as smart or didn't bring value to your business? If you give or sell equity to someone, you have to be absolutely convinced it will grow the company. In many cases, you keep half of the company, but end up doing triple the work. Triple? Yep. You'll do three times the work, partly because you have to spend time fixing problems and differences with the other partners. At the early stages of starting your company, it's tempting to undervalue yourself and your company, particularly if it brings in people who show great initial value and expertise. But do you want them to be driving the train alongside you or riding in preferred seating? Watch out for VIPs, very inordinately paid specialists. Don't give away equity or lots of money to bring in VIPs. VIPs are perceived to be of tremendous value because they have big names, or add credibility to your company, or have key contacts, or bring some other value to the table. More often than not, however, they don't deliver. It's simple, really. VIPs don't deliver because they don't have to. They receive the reward, money or equity, before doing anything. Think about it. Would you have started a business if you were already receiving the money, success, and effect that you want to achieve? Probably not. Know that for business, you are the VIP. It's your blood, sweat, and tears, damn it. And for that, you should be rewarded, not some freeloading VIP. Ideas are worth the time spent on them. New business ideas are easy to think up and even easier to dream about. The next big thing is only a couple of beers, a few friends, and 35 minutes away. And it's right there at the bar where the equity distribution is discussed. One third all the way around, man. We're all going to be rich. Another round of Milwaukee's best. On me! If you are the schmo who then puts the majority of effort into getting the idea off the ground, you've just given away the farm. Ideas don't make money. Effort does. Some ideas require a tremendous amount of effort and time. Think cool invention, working prototype, patent, and salivating customer base. Add monumental effort and hard work, and your business may be worth something. Gauge the value of your idea on the effort, not on the idea alone. Angels and VCs suck. Kinda. Let me preface this by telling you that I am a little bitter here. I have dealt with VCs and angels and did not have a pretty experience. Not all angels, high net worth individuals who invest in businesses, are bad. And not all VCs, venture capitalists, suck. They did bring us Google, Starbucks, and other super successes after all. But let's get real here. VCs and angels are putting money in your business as an investment. They fully want and expect to get a significant return and fast. They are not philanthropists. They are in the business of making money. I'm not saying that these are bad people or even that there is no value in working with them. You just need to have absolute clarity about what their objective is. Have you ever bought stock in a public company, maybe on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ? What mattered to you most? That the stock went up and quick, right? Your goal was to sell quickly for big gains, right? Did you care about the cohesiveness of the management team or employee morale? Were you concerned about the personal fiscal health of the top decision makers? Did you wonder if the president had enough time to make it to the family reunion that weekend? Hell no! That stuff probably never, ever even crossed your mind. Your goal was to invest, make good money, and get out. That's the behavior of 98% of the VCs and angels out there. While there are a few differences between VCs slash angels and a stock investment, one is significant. When you buy stock, there are thousands and thousands of other investors in there with you. Effectively, you spread your risk with others. You all want the company to succeed, but if it fails, you all go down together. Angels and VCs invest with two or three others, not thousands. Hence, their risk is magnified. They are investing in a startup company, risky, and they're going it alone or nearly alone, even riskier. With this level of risk, VCs and angels have a serious interest in the success of your company. So they don't just give you money, sit back, and watch. They often take control too. So if you go the VC slash angel route, know that you are an investment, not a partner. And if they don't like how things are going, they will take control and not give it back. There is an appropriate time to consider seeking out VCs and angels, though. And this is typically once you are already bringing in millions in revenue. At a certain point, your growth can be rapidly boosted through an injection of money. That's when you should consider these types of investors. I suggest that you approach angels after you are in the millions, and VCs when you're in the tens of millions. At that point, you may be very happy with how things are going and may even consider being your own angel. The right way to balance equity and partnering. Are you still convinced that you can't go it alone, that you will be more successful with the right partner? You may be right. It worked for Sergey Brin and Larry Page. Here are the right ways to choose a partner for your business. Rather than go in 50-50, let the partner who's performing at the highest level have the majority of the company. Performance-based equity distribution motivates both partners to work hard and creatively for the success of the company and rewards the partner that excels. Determine specific metrics and critical goals for the company's growth. These may include sales volume, billable hours worked, purchase savings, customer feedback, and product/services developed. Have at least three performance variables, but no more than five. Then, every quarter for the next 2.5 years, review the achievements and split 10% of the equity. At the end of these 10 quarters, the entire 100% of company equity will be assigned, and the partners will be fairly rewarded for their contribution to the overall success. It's a big deal to be small. Partner or not, funded or not, you will start small. This is a very, very big deal, and you can use it to grow big. Would you call Walmart an intimate experience? Not at all. It is sterile to say the least, and in my opinion, a little creepy. It seems like it ships the same weird-looking, funky-smelling, sweatpants-wearing customers from store to store. But the prices are cheap, so I still go often, and I get out quickly. The mega stores and mega businesses have an important place in the business world, but they don't have the only place. It is a big deal being a small business. The world needs you. Actually, the world starves for you. The number-crunching megastore machine can't match the intimacy and nimbleness of a small business, nor its ability to make every single client feel important. This is your advantage in being small, and you need to exploit it big time. Not much to lose. Think about it. You have very little to lose. This is quite possibly your biggest advantage. If an idea has potential, you'll go for it because you have nothing to protect. The underdog. Everyone loves to root for the underdog. Take college football. The nation went crazy over Appalachian State's win over Michigan, except for Michigan fans, during the first week of the 2007-2008 season because the Appalachian State Mountaineers were big-time underdogs. The game was professionally commented on more than any other game in history. Leverage the fact that you're an underdog. People just can't help rooting for you, and word gets out quickly when you pull out the win. Speed. You can move faster and more nimbly than the big guys. All the red tape, backstabbing, political games, and bureaucracy that occur at big corporations don't happen within a small company, especially when it's just you. You can make a decision in seconds that will take them days or weeks. You can be in, out, and invoiced before they even return the call. Use speed to your advantage. It matters. If you have 10 clients and you lose one, that's 10% of your business. If a megastore loses one, it doesn't care. It cares about the overall trend. As a nascent startup, you not only want to do what it takes to find and keep good clients, you have to do what it takes. Every client is a big deal, and you must make sure he feels like a big deal when doing business with you. If you can pull that off, clients will always choose you over the big guys. Intimacy. Building on the "it matters" concept, when you are small and have the ability to get to know your clients very well, some of them may even become personal friends, and others will become key customers. All of your clients should be treated like best friends. Get to know them beyond business. What do they care about? What are they interested in? What do they need? Deep down inside, we all want to walk, just like Norm from Cheers, into a bar where everyone not only knows our name, they stop, look over, and welcome us in. That level of personal attention will keep them coming back. Break the rules. The big boys have been around the block so many times that they adhere to rules they no longer need. Some established industries get stuck in the mode of doing things a certain way just because they've always been done that way. A small, nimble competitor like you can identify the industry rules, take what you need, and then break the rest wide open. Throw out the way it has always been. Tim Ferriss, the author of The 4-Hour Workweek, won the Chinese National Kickboxing Championship by breaking the rules. Well, not really by breaking the rules. He actually broke the expectations. He broke the tradition. On a dare, Tim decided to compete in the kickboxing championship. With only 4 weeks to prepare for the event, Tim was clearly at a disadvantage against competitors who'd been in the league for years. He was facing opponents who had committed their lives to the sport. They were born to win. They were the big guys. Tim was the small guy and didn't have a chance, at least not without breaking, or in Tim's case, exploiting the rules. Rather than take on the impossible task of achieving the performance and experience level of the masters, Tim hit the books. He studied the known and not so known rules of the league. It was here that he discovered the rule that would bring him victory. If he was able to throw a competitor out of the competition ring 3 times during a match, the competitor would be disqualified and the victory would go to Tim. This rule played exactly into Tim's talent, his natural strength in throwing things. This time, he just needed to throw people. The day of the championship, the masters bowed, boxed, and kicked people. Tim bowed, dodged, and threw people. Tim won. Tim Ferriss is a toilet paper entrepreneur. Take action now. No more exercises, no more pondering, no more psyching yourself up. Your last task is to take one giant leap off the cliff and launch your business, if you haven't already done so. Show us what you're made of. Join the few, the proud, the toilet paper entrepreneurs. Bonus: the youth and young at heart advantage. The greatest disadvantage of young people today is that they have too many advantages. Anonymous. Unless you know the secret to the fountain of youth, you'll only be young once. Milk it for all it's worth. I sure did. I pulled many all-nighters, paid little mind to my unique living conditions, and plowed ahead with excitement and hope for the future. You can go far on hard work and big dreams, often a hell of a lot farther and faster than people with more education and experience. Resilience. Youth brings an ability to rebound that many people lose as they age, unless they remain young at heart. This resilience allows you to bounce back after defeat and try again unscathed. The entrepreneurial path is littered with pitfalls and roadblocks. You need the capacity to come back again and again relentlessly. No false pretense. How come most curmudgeons are gray-haired folk? Probably because they are pissed at how life turned out and depressed about the lackluster ride ahead of them. The young foresee many more possibilities and great experiences ahead. The old saying is true. As a young person, your life is still ahead of you. The best part is, you can determine just how great a ride it will be. If you are a curmudgeon, your life ain't over yet either, fella. Make it a great ride. Few responsibilities. Most young people fresh out of college don't have children and spouses to support. You can put all of your energy into launching your company the right way. This is a huge advantage. Energy. No question, a young person has more energy than an older person. Likewise, a person at any age who is living their passion has tremendous amounts of energy. If you are young and living your passion, you are unstoppable. No preconceived notions. Young people, in general, are far more willing to try something new than older people. Just think about the crazy things you tried in college. No need to share. Just think about it and keep that smile to yourself. As we age, we often look back at our younger years and can't believe the crazy things we tried. We become less and less open to risk because of all the fears we've picked up along the way. Be young, be crazy, and launch your company now. Flexible schedule. You pulled the all-nighters in high school and college and still made it to the keg parties with your friends the next day. Without commitments to your own family, you can exploit the flexibility of the single life. You can party all day and work all night. Or is it the other way around? Money isn't a big deal. You've been eating ramen noodles for the last 4 years. Another couple of years won't kill you. Since most young folks have yet to experience what it is like to have lots of money, going without wouldn't be much of a hardship. Plus, when you start young and poor, there's only one way to go. Up. Chicken pork oriental, anyone? The clock is ticking and you're getting older. Use these advantages while you have them or someone else will. Tick, tick, tick. Ivy League or county college. So what? I don't care how smart you are or how talented you are or what college you went to. When it comes to launching a company, that stuff just doesn't matter. What does matter is how smart you believe you are, how talented you believe you are, how driven you are, how focused you are, how persistent you are. I have presented at college campuses throughout the U.S., from the Ivy Leagues to the community colleges. Almost every student I meet explains how her education is about mastering certain processes. 14 weeks of accounting 101, 16 weeks of investment strategies, etc. This is important stuff, don't get me wrong, but it sure as hell won't have a significant impact on starting a company. To the contrary, if this is the stuff you worry about when you are starting out, you are doomed. The early days of business are about survival. Classes for cooking on a dime and how to make one cheap suit look like three different not-so-cheap suits will probably better serve you. It doesn't matter what your background is or how much education you have. What matters is what you believe you can or can't do. Yes, your background and experience have a great influence on your beliefs. But once you realize you have the right and the ability to change your beliefs, you can achieve whatever you envision. So, if you are a college dropout, don't sell yourself short. You can achieve the same level of success an Ivy Leaguer can, and will most likely pass by those well-educated types in a blink of an eye. Just follow your passion, be relentlessly persistent, and truly, truly believe in yourself. The same applies to Ivy grads. Once college is over, we are all on common footing. The people who believe the most will achieve the most. Move in with your mom and other painful thoughts. If you are a young entrepreneur, you may have good fortune in a supportive mom and dad. If your folks will let you move home after college, then use this to your advantage as long as you and they can stand it. I know you don't want to live with them any more than you have to, but if you bunk with your folks for a year or two after college, you can save some serious coin. Just don't live at home into your 30s or 40s. That's just plain old embarrassing. Reduce your personal and business expenses by starting your company in the basement or your bedroom. Borrow the car, use the home phone, and there's nothing better than mom's home cooking. Besides, it's free. eat at home and have the leftovers for lunch. Need part-time staff? Perhaps Uncle George can help with the accounting and Aunt Jane can handle email inquiries. Maybe Mom and Dad can be your office cleaning crew. Mine were. Launching a business is about surviving and doing it intelligently. No, it's not glamorous to have Mommy answering the phone or Uncle George reviewing the books, but it is economical and prudent. Save your money, every cent you can, and use the pennies you have to grow. Live off the land as long as you can. Master Bocce Ball. Too old to move back home or have another really good reason not to? There is still a way. There's always a way. I found a way when I started my first company. I could have moved home, but it would have been tough since I was engaged and had a child. Try springing that one on the folks. Hey, Ma, great news. I just started my first company. Yep, but it gets better. I found the girl of my dreams, and we're going to get married. No, that's not all. I'm going to have a son. Would you mind if we all moved back home? Nope, that wouldn't have worked for any of us. Not my folks, my wife, or me. So we needed to find an alternative. And when you have no money, it is amazing what you can do. Within a few short days, my wife had found a retirement complex that welcomed us with open, flabby arms. That's right, an old age community for people between 80 and dead. So why choose a retirement community at the tender age of 24? Because we could afford it. Rent was something like $475 a month for a two-bedroom. For New Jersey in 1995, that was a great deal. Plus, the retirees made some good food. Life was not luxurious, but we managed and ate a lot of ramen noodles and hand-me-down fruitcake. And of course, we became masters of bocce ball and pinochle. If you have the will, there is a way. You may have to eat a little of your pride, but it is worth it, and it builds character. Who knows? Maybe you and I can have a no-nonsense pinochle game one day. Winner gets a coupon for the early bird special. Still in school? Graduate profitably. When the last final exam is done and the last beer bash concludes, your classmates will trot their way home with the parting words, "See you next year, biatch!" They are off to enjoy some summer sun and maybe get a summer job. You should not follow suit. This is an opportunity to launch a small business, even if it just is for a few months. Make a product that you can sell. Freelance a service you have to offer. Do whatever you want that can make money. This is about making some payola and learning the critical parts of starting a company. Plus, you probably will make more than the minimum wage and have a lot more fun doing it. Hold on a minute. What about a polished resume that you can show to a future employer? If you are thinking along those lines, you are reading the wrong book. This is about learning the core principles of running a successful business, and there is no education better than doing it. But what happens when you have to get back to school? You have options here. You can close up shop, or you may be able to keep your business rolling along. Part-time, of course, you do want to keep up the grades and get a good education. Try to recruit a few people on campus to work for you, but avoid using friends so that you can treat them as beer buddies, not colleagues. This is an opportunity to build your leadership skills and learn to manage a team. Make the most of your college days. Make a little bit of money. And most importantly, don't forget to party. Party. You and your folks lay down some serious cabbage to pay for your college education. And you better take full advantage of it. Go out and party right now. You heard me. Party. I am not suggesting you get involved in a booze fest. Well, maybe just a few. I am suggesting you learn how to communicate with others and network. Entrepreneurial success is dependent upon your ability to lead and communicate with people. You're going to be the CEO, communicator, energizer, and organizer of your new business, so you better start acting like one. Use your party time at school to find the people you click with. Investigate what it is about your closest friends that you like. What are the values they share with you, with others? Figure out the best and fastest way to meet other people who share your values. Try planning a party, strictly legal, of course, with your friends. Can you set a common vision of how the party will go down? Can you get your friends to not just buy in, but feverishly support you? How can you make the party all with volunteer work? Can you get people to do the PR, the collections and accounting, purchasing, and customer service? This is a great opportunity to learn about your own values, hone your skills, discover your strengths, and learn how you best manage people. If at the end of the night, everyone makes a toast to you and applauds you for a job well done, then congratulations. You have potential to be a great CEO. You also have a backup plan as an events coordinator. The not-so-hidden bonus section. Tom, the big crapper. It would be a sin not to include the story of Thomas Crapper in this book. I can't think of a more fitting way to use these final pages. Mr. Thomas the Big Crapper was an entrepreneur, plumber, purported inventor of the flushing toilet, and a guy with the best name ever. I gave him the nickname The Big. It's poetic license. Although Crapper held 9 plumbing patents, none were for the flushing toilet that he is often credited with inventing. Instead, Crapper was a sanitary engineer during the 19th century who ran his own plumbing company and owned many patents. Today, 100 years later, all over London, you can still see manhole covers emblazoned with his name. Crapper had an extraordinary entrepreneurial run by any measure. The results were financial fortune and eternal fame. He achieved this by 1. Acting as if. He was a plumber who acted as if he belonged in the big leagues and was treated as if he was already there. 2. Exploiting strengths. He knew the industry. He could close down the deals and he could sell. Little did he know, his name would be his best asset. Crapper is the only entrepreneur in the world who, more than 100 years after his death, can still say he is number one in the number two business. 3. Small was big. He was a small operation his whole life, but look at the fortune and fame it brought him. He was nimble and jumped on opportunity. 4. Belief, focus, and action. He knew he would succeed. He stuck with his business and stayed acutely focused on what he wanted. Crapper did not quit. He just kept marching forward. His products still line the streets of London. That's what belief, focus, and action will get you. 5. Toilet paper entrepreneur. Through and through, Crapper was a TPE. He didn't come from a silver-spooned media darling background. He held himself solely accountable for his own success. He exploited a niche. He had strong beliefs, he knew exactly what he wanted, and he got up, or sat down, and did it. According to Plumbing and Mechanical magazine, Tom Crapper, quote, should best be remembered as a merchant of plumbing products, a terrific salesman, and advertising genius, end quote. Technically, the origins of how Crapper became a synonym for toilet are unknown. But you and I both know that it can only be the work of a toilet paper entrepreneur. Thomas Crapper, unquestionably, is a toilet paper entrepreneur. Are you the next toilet paper entrepreneur? I hope so. Actually, I know so if you know so. So no more jibber-jabber. There's nothing else to discuss. This is your moment. It's your turn to succeed. You can clean up with just 3 sheets. All you need to do is get down to business. Now.
This has been The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur, written by me, Mike Michalowicz, and narrated by me, Mike Michalowicz. If you like the book, or not, either way, I'd appreciate an honest review.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.